Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Current state for Tuesday, I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. And if you're a University of Michigan fan, you well know what happened last night.
Unbelievably well-coached club. They just have an answer for everybody.
And that will do it as Louisville completes the emotional journey to the championship.
In the NCAA championship game in Atlanta, Michigan came out guns blazing in the first half, and it looked as though the Wolverines might bring home their first championship since 1989, but the Louisville Cardinals snatched the victory away in the second half with an 82-76 win. It was one hot hand in the first half of the game and another hot hand in the second half of the game. It marked Louisville's third NCAA title. And we want to congratulate the Cardinals, and there's always next year for Michigan or Michigan State. We were going to stir this up with Joe Rexrow of the Detroit Free Press, but Joe had such a long night. He's been in bed for about a half an hour or so, so we decided to let him sleep and update it here that way. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. A Michigan State University plant biology professor is playing a unique role in piecing together a tragic West Michigan crime. Dr. Frank Tolusky is part of an effort to locate a Ludington infant who was abducted and likely killed by her father in 2011. Tolusky and other professionals have analyzed bits of plant material found on the man's shoes in an attempt to find the four-month-old's remains. Using the findings, investigators plan to narrow the search this summer. And to find out more about this curious story, we welcome Dr. Frank Tolusky to Current State. Frank, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
And we're also joined by Peter Carrington, who is one of Frank's graduate students in plant biology. How are you, Peter?
Good morning. Good.
The victim in this tragedy has come to be known as Baby Kate. Catherine Phillips was 4 months old in June of 2011 when her parents had an argument. The girl's father, Sean Phillips, takes her, drives off. Frank, what do the authorities think happened after that?
Well, he vanished with the car and the baby and drove around, and the police have been trying to reconstruct his whereabouts. There is some evidence that was picked up and some witness statements, as well as some of his own statements that he's made that indicates that he stopped off at a variety of places around town before he disappeared someplace into the woods, the wooded areas, the remote areas of Mason County. And before showing up about an hour or so later at his parents' house where he had been living north of town. So you know, the question is, you know, where was he and what was he doing at the time?
And he took off with the baby. The baby was obviously gone here in that intervening hour here. Where is he now? Where is Sean Phillips?
He's serving time on an unlawful imprisonment charge right now. So he has been tried last year and is serving time on that charge, but he has not been charged with murder at this point in time.
Okay, but the authorities think that he is responsible for the baby's death.
That's correct.
Okay. And explain how you came to be involved then.
Well, when the police showed up at Sean Phillips' parents' house, he had been there. And so they found out that he had the baby's clothes, baby Kate's clothes in his pockets. And the baby seat was tucked in the back of the trunk of the car, but there was no baby. And so obviously they had arrested him since the baby was missing. And the detective on the case, Detective Wells, was observant enough to notice that the shoes he had been wearing were coated in mud. And so he got the shoes as evidence.
Okay.
and began looking around for a forensic expert that could do some soil identification. And so he was referenced to our well-known forensics program here through Dr. David Foran, who's the director of the Forensic Science Program and director of Forensic Biology Laboratory here in the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State.
Okay.
And so he has a list of faculty, and myself included, who have a very variety of expertise in possibly serving in the forensic capacity. And so he passed the shoes and the evidence on to Professor James Crum in the Crop and Soil Sciences Department. And Dr. Crum was able to identify the soil very clearly as a windblown sand, which for West Michigan is not overly uncommon given the sand dune nature of the environment.
Right.
And but what Dr. Crum noticed was that there was plant material associated with the plant fragments and fruit, small fruit associated with the soil. And so he said, well, you know, Frank Talusky, Dr. Talusky should be able to help us on that. Why don't we send, you know, the evidence up to Talusky's lab and see what he can come up with for identification. So that's how I got involved.
Okay. And how much did you have to work with? These were tiny bits of plant material. Peter Carrington, you worked on this. How much did you have to work with?
There was only about a gram, really, or less of material, very small amounts. But since it had been rinsed out of this sandy mud, it was in good condition, some of it, and a variety of pieces, many of which were recognizable, were extracted out of it.
Okay. And you are trying to do what now with the plant material that you've identified?
Well, it's interesting is that the mud and a sticky, you know, the muddy sand is kind of a mucky, sandy soil.
Okay.
Had a sticky consistency to it. And so as he walked through the woods, he was literally collecting a sample of material from where he walked. And so if we make the assumption that he parked the car someplace and he got out of the car and he walked into the woods, you know, with the infant, and he's got came in contact with this mud and it starts picking up this plant material, we may be able to connect the dots and reconstruct a path which he may have followed. So all of these plants are not – we don't expect to find all these plants in one specific location, but – along a path, so if we can kind of connect dots together. So, and one of the key things is that we found this sedge, working with Dr. Tony Resnicek from the University of Michigan, who's a global expert in sedges, identified them as being a particular species that's fairly uncommon in Mason County. It's more common in other areas of Michigan, but within Mason area, it's uncommon. So that's kind of becoming our focal plant species that we're looking for. And then with the other nine species of plants that we have, we're hoping to be able to narrow down the possible search areas that the police department then can concentrate their search on for a body. So we're not looking for baby Kate. We're looking for the plant material that was associated with his shoe.
So a gram of biomass was 10 different species?
Yes.
That's amazing. That sounds like, how can you explain that?
Well, it's actually relatively simple. We have some photographs here you can take a look at. But you look at the plant species, they're really pretty tiny. But you can tell a lot from a tiny piece of plant material. These fruit of the carex are very small. They are fruit. They are characteristics of a given species. They were fragments of pine needles. They were fragments of other plant leaves. And they're very characteristics of plant material. We don't even need DNA. I mean, a lot of people say CSIO, you know, you could take the DNA, identify it. Well, there's enough morphology. There's enough morphological characteristics in these fruit and in these plant fragments that we're able to give a positive identification to where these what these plants represent.
So you're ostensibly searching for a combination of different kinds of plants.
Correct.
Okay, that's it. And investigators, I'm led to believe, have eliminated some promising areas already?
Yes, we have.
Okay, and why?
Well,
do you know that?
Well, because we don't have the plant associations there.
Okay, they just didn't match up.
Right.
Okay, and you're trying to line up volunteers for this project. Tell everybody what you have planned
sure.
for later this summer.
The Ludington Police Department is calling for volunteers. We're looking for about 100, 150 volunteers, people who would be interested in a search, who would have maybe a basic knowledge of botany, plant identification, some aspect of plant science. We're hoping that maybe we can encourage some MSU students and faculty and staff that if they're interested in participating in this. It would be the last weekend in June 28th and 29th up in Ludington, opportunity to be out in the field in Mason County and work with some of the experts. So we'll be working, I'll be there Peter Carrington will be there, and some folks from the Field Museum in Chicago. The Field Museum in Chicago has also played an important role in helping identify some of the moss species and some of the other plant species that we found, to down to specific taxa. Whereas I was able to get it down to genus, they were able to really take it a next step further.
Oh, about that. Peter Carrington, this sounds like quite a learning experience for a graduate student in plant biology.
Well, it's an excellent opportunity to test your skills, both in looking for interesting details in a soil sample. I have some experience in working on soil samples with arthropods, which turned up some orbotid mites and some other things in the soil. But this is a great opportunity to see how a few small fragments can be learned from.
It seems as if, ostensibly you're looking for plants here, but it seems as if the father was gone with the baby for an hour or so, you said?
I don't remember the exact time frame, but it was somewhere along that, in that period of time, yes.
It seems a volunteer is almost as likely to discover the remains themselves as they are the plants that you're searching for if he wasn't gone that far from Ludington. This was Ludington, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Right. I wouldn't rule out the possibility that that could happen. It would be fantastic if it did. I think it would be, make very short work for the rest of the investigation. Of course, if anybody did come across the remains, they would be instructed. We'll go through a training and instruction period, but, you would not touch it. You would back away from that site. It is a crime scene. You would need to let the forensic experts come in and really document that location. So, don't touch. Plants, yes, you can plant touch, but you can touch plants. But if you see anything that looks out of the ordinary or suspicious that might be human-related, leave it alone. Call the experts.
Yeah. The authorities announced the plans for this search a few days ago. Do you know if the public has started to respond?
Yes. Detective Wells has indicated that he has received several applications already. It's still early. We've got a few months to go, but we'd certainly like to see those numbers swell and get a really good volunteer corps out there that we can actually begin to narrow down these areas and really focus the search.
You're also the director of the Beale Botanical Garden here at Michigan State, which is a treasure here in East Lansing in mid-Michigan. There's nothing like a visit to Beale Garden in midsummer or any time. I imagine this is the time of year the garden's getting a lot busier.
Yes, we opened up the gates of the Botanical Garden on April 1st. My staff is down there working on getting things prepared, repairing the various winter damage and cleanup. We have winter aconite and snowdrops in bloom, so things are starting to happen down in the garden. And I'd like to also put a little plug in. It is our 140th anniversary this year, so we're hoping to have an open house sometime this fall. More information to follow.
Good place to learn, Peter Carrington. Do you spend much time in the Beale Gardens? Just
every moment I can,
okay.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
I have ever since the early 70s, in fact. And of course, at the time, I had no clue that someday I would be involved.
Oh,
but
it
is certainly a heartwarming adventure in science to be there.
My blood pressure drops 10 points just thinking about the Beale Gardens. It's a real treasure.
I think it's a very important role of gardens and botanical gardens around the world, around the country.
Yeah, just fantastic. Well, very interesting to have both of you in, and good luck with your search. Dr. Frank Tolusky and Peter Carrington, one of his grad students in plant biology here at Michigan State University, and the story of baby Kate. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Every Tuesday, we partner with the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism and the Great Lakes Echo to bring you a segment featuring environmental news here in the Great Lakes region. This week, we focus on lead poisoning. A story from Environmental Health News reports that lead poisoning in children in Detroit has decreased 70% since 2004. However, children with excessive lead levels in Detroit still exceed the national average, and funding for lead cleanup is dwindling. Brian Benkowski is a senior editor and staff writer at Environmental Health News. He told me that the lead poisoning can mainly be attributed to old paint.
Most researchers agree that the number one cause is older homes and the lead-based paint that was used in them. Lead was banned in paint in 1978, and as I say in the article, Detroit has a large number of homes that were built prior to that. I think 94% of the homes were built before 1980. So that's the primary cause. But also in Detroit and these industrial cities, there was lead smelters and other outdoor sources that continue to kind of plague the city's children.
And for the record, Brian, what are some of the effects of lead poisoning in kids?
Mark, it's primarily neurological. So it's been linked to in many, many health studies to decreased IQ, behavioral issues, antisocial behavior, things of that nature. And also there's some nascent research, and maybe not so nascent in some instances, that it's linked to violence, an increase in violence in children.
Okay, but it's a cognitive issue that could very well show up in school or performance
very
in
much
school.
So, yeah, yeah. There was a recent study out of Detroit that took a look at lead poisoning in children and then test scores on the MEEP exams. And there was a clear linkage between children that had been exposed to high levels of lead and performing much lower on test scores.
But there's an issue apparently of industrial dust as well on top of the houses.
Right, right. As I said, most researchers agree that that the primary cause is indoor paint,
yeah,
and dust from older homes. But also Detroit and Cleveland and Chicago and Milwaukee, there used to be, in some cases, some neighborhoods still are, a lot of industry and lead smelting in some of these areas, most of which is gone now. But there's still this legacy lead buried in the soil. And it's shown that in the summertime, when there's more dust and kids are outside, that levels spike in children. And that's primarily from those outdoor legacy contaminants.
There has been a dramatic decrease in the number of kids who have lead poisoning just since 2004, under 10 years, from 10,000 or so to under 3,000. What's this decrease all about?
Right. Yeah, I think there's many factors. One was this confluence of both health research and this realization that the city's kids were heavily poisoned by lead. There was very high levels of lead in Detroit, and about a decade ago, between the health research and that realization, I think there was a real strong effort to get rid of homes, to pass laws that made landlords take care of legacy lead and paint, more screening programs. And like most things in Detroit, this wasn't a purely municipal effort. This was both city and nonprofits. And it was a real group effort by a lot of folks in the city to tackle it.
Well, it not only is it cleaning up old houses, I guess, but Detroit, as everybody knows, is shrinking. Some of these old houses are getting demolished too.
Right, right. Yeah. Mayor Dave Bing has a initiative to demolish, if I'm correct, something like 6,000-7,000 homes, or maybe it's 10,000, and he's already done 6,000-7,000 homes, and that's certainly part of it. I mean, it's a city with a lot of older homes, and the more you can get rid of these contaminated homes, the less children are living in them.
When a house with lead in it is demolished, is it being demolished in a way to curtail the lead dust? I mean, are there standards for that kind of thing or not?
Right, right. That's a good question. And that's not something I got into in the article. And I would imagine, I'm assuming that there's some protocols so they're not leaving piles of lead dust and other old contaminants.
I only ask because the stricter standards seem to be having an effect here.
Sure.
Partly.
Sure.
Partly, at least. So I'm just curious how far those standards go.
Sure, sure. You know? Yeah, and I'm sure there's protocols for that, but that's not something I specifically looked into.
A lot of the money in this cleanup efforts come from the Center for Disease Control, but funding for cleanup efforts across the country has been cut, as the article noted, from $30 million to just $2 million, a real dramatic cut there. Is there any fear that the funding cuts will diminish some of the momentum that Detroit's making?
Yeah. For sure. There's quite a bit of fear. I don't think it's any secret that Detroit has quite a bit of financial and political turmoil right
sure.
now. And most people I talked to said that, the federal funding was heavily relied upon to tackle lead. But, there is some HUD grants there's some state level grants that are still kind of picking up the slack here. But certainly, anytime you have that kind of decrease, and I want to say about $1 million came to Detroit from the CDC every year to tackle lead. So, you know, anytime you take away that amount of money, it's going to be some consequences.
And still, despite this improvement over the past 9 years or so, still 10% of Detroit kids age 6 or younger still have levels of lead that are considered excessive. The national average is just under 6%.
Right.
So.
Right.
The article also points out that lead poisoning or addressing lead poisoning, I should say, in effect pays for itself. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the downstream costs of lead poisoning, you know, whether that's in the education system having to have bolstered special education, or in as I said, it's linked to violence. So if you look either further downstream into the jail, you know, the jail system or juvenile detention centers. The cost of preventing children from having this neurological impairment in the first place, it ends up paying for itself. Much like, you know, I think one of the Wayne State researchers compares it to like a vaccination program, where if you have this upfront cost of preventing this illness, this sickness, which you know, lead poisoning can be compared to an illness, you know, you don't have these downstream costs.
The environment in Detroit has, in a sense, become your beat. It seems like so many of the environmental problems in the city stem from trying to clean up the city's industrial past, which is renowned, of course. Will we be cleaning up messes 40 years down the line that we're making today?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, Detroit's such an interesting case and such an interesting place to be a reporter because it's...
Well, the economy is being reforged, really.
Right.
The economies everywhere are being reforged,
right.
But in Detroit, maybe even more so. And it's arguable that there will be a whole lot less manufacturing in Detroit's
right.
future than there has been in its past.
Right. And I mean, you're looking at the first, I mean, there's been some cases. You look at Pittsburgh, what was primarily a steel economy and it's transformed. So there's some cases, but not on the scale of Detroit where you're trying to have a city become this post-industrial place. And the most interesting thing, in my view, with Detroit is the amount of land and kind of what they want to do with land use. And I think that'll go a far way in terms of cleanup, in terms of what kind of economy is going to move the city forward. I think that land use question, and there's all kinds of crazy ideas out there, and I guess it's time to throw them against the wall and see what sticks.
For all of its challenges, Detroit strikes me as an exciting place to be in a way, because the future is so unplotted. It's drawn an awful lot of young people with a lot of energy to the city. Dan Gilbert is playing a huge role in revitalizing commerce in Detroit, I think. What's it like to be in Detroit, to be there at all? At this time.
Right. No, I couldn't agree more. I absolutely, I think it's one of the most fascinating places in our country because you have this large contingent of middle class and lower to middle class people, you know, hardworking blue collar type folks and that have primarily made up the city for so many years. And then now you have this undercurrent of the creative younger folks that are trying to make a change. And those two groups of people, for me anyway, having grown up in the Rust Belt here, are just such fascinating people to be around and to see the different ideas being thrown around. And I have a lot of confidence that the city's gonna make a big comeback here.
Brian, will the appointment of an emergency financial manager for Detroit, will that have some kind of impact down the road on these environmental challenges that Detroit faces in terms of cleanup, lead poisoning, what have you?
Well, that's hard to tell right now. I don't know if anybody really knows the trajectory of what Mr. Orr is going to do down there. But I know with his appointment, the idea is, and hopefully he brings this to the office. I mean, the number one goal is public protection, public health, public services, you know. In a city where streetlights are off and crime is endemic and there's these environmental challenges, I hope that, I hope those environmental challenges go along with the streetlights and the crime and the poverty, because, I mean, these are all under the umbrella of quality of life, you know, human health and protecting the people of the city. So I guess the best I can say is I hope that's part of his plan.
Brian Benkowski is a senior editor and staff writer at Environmental Health News. Brian, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
Newsweek magazine has stopped publishing a print edition and is now digital only. Other publications are doing the same. If digital publishing is indeed where the future of non-broadcast journalism lies, the Michigan State University School of Journalism is beginning to train students to be ready. A senior-level class has published Glyph magazine for the iPad. They used software from Adobe called InDesign to build a digital magazine with video clips and graphics that make information pop off the screen. Two editions of Glyph are available at no charge in Apple's App Store. WKAR's Scott Pohl talked with Professor Cheryl Pell and students Nate Zamanek and Danielle Turcotte about the project.
Our topic, overarching for all four classes, was mental health. And my particular group was doing college mental health students. And so we assigned stories. The students, you know, chose the stories that they were interested in doing. And then they wrote the stories. We had a lot of editing and so forth. And then that formed the basis of the magazine. And then after that, they had to work to earn points. They had to do various things. Danielle here took many, many photographs for the class, and as a good photographer would do. And they were fantastic. And then Nate was our producer. He's the one who made it, made the bells and whistles work in the program.
There were certain days where we all came together and we kind of did a big class edit. And so what I did beforehand was I actually read everybody's story and tried to think of ideas in mind. And so we came together and I would tell each person, I'd be like, well, I think this would work really well for this story. And so I kind of let the writer also give me feedback if they thought that was a good idea, so I'm not just totally ruining their vision, but I actually got to get really creative with it, which was exciting and challenging, too, because sometimes I didn't know where I would find someone to have something to fit the story.
And the great thing about having an iPad as your form factor is that you're not necessarily limited to the physical space that you are on pages, and you can do much more dynamic and interesting things. When we had an excess flow of content, we could maybe think about ways that we could use that content to enhance the interactive feel of the magazine in a way that you don't get with paper.
Nate, tell us more about your role in the project.
I'm actually a telecommunications major, but I originally started planning on going into journalism. That was a real big interest of mine. So when Cheryl said she had this Jern 400 capstone class and they were going to do this amazing iPad magazine, she said, look, I don't really have someone on here with the technical know-how. I've got some great writers, some great designers, and I know you can do both, and you can also do some of the techie things. So could you come in and help us? And so that's where I came to the project. And it was really fascinating to me because InDesign, that's what the professionals use. That's what Newsweek uses. That's what Time Magazine uses. I mean, that's what all the big newspaper designers, magazine designers use. And I've been using it for years, but there's a layer that's on top of InDesign that's very new that Adobe's trying to push that allows you to do this interactive stuff on the iPad. It's kind of an extra layer on top of the design. So you design it regularly like a magazine. And then once you have a structure of a page, you can work in on another higher level thinking about, well, how can this work on a screen? And how can people touch and navigate around the magazine and give them more of an experience of flowing through your content, more of a physical experience, and not just reading with your eye, but actually interacting with the page with your fingers and touching things and things appear or disappear, or using multimedia. We have some videos in the magazine that are really, really nice and really well produced by some of the other students. And we really tried to run the full gamut of different ways of expressing ourselves using this great new thing, the tablet, the iPad, to tell our stories. And that's my role, was helping to facilitate that, at least from a technical level.
You know, when I first looked at it myself, I was taken at the graphic layout in terms of some of the stuff you were just talking about, where you touch the screen and something pops out of the graphic you're looking at that goes into greater detail about the information you're trying to learn about. The phrase that popped into my mind at the time was the digital magazine of the future, which is dumb, of course, because it's the digital magazine of today since you're doing it today.
Well, as far as I know, we're one of the only and Cheryl can help me out with this. We're one of the only college-level journalism departments who are actually producing iPad magazines, at least in Michigan, that we know of.
In Michigan. There are a few others out there, but
there's definitely other smaller projects out there, but it's really on the horizon of things right now. Mm-hmm. But we're also seeing the move away from paper, I mean, like Newsweek doesn't exist as a magazine anymore. They're going to be a website and they're going to be mm-hmm. tablet magazine. And this is the tool that they're using. So MSU is very forward thinking.
And one of our grads is doing that iPad magazine for Newsweek, which I think is exciting.
And that's why I think we were all so drawn to this idea of creating a digital magazine or an iPad magazine, because we're still doing everything that a normal magazine would do. We'd be telling stories that matter, but we're doing it in more of an innovative way and kind of doing something that a lot of people haven't even seen yet. So it's exciting.
I just wanted to point out to Nate and Danielle, having looked at Glyph, the two of you are scheduled to graduate in May. If you want to do this for a living, I must say that if you showed up at my job interview and showed me Glyph and explained your role in it, you probably would have a job offer before you left my office.
That's nice. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope so.
I mean, this is the thing is, as a journalist and as a content producer, this is where things are going very largely as far as written content goes. It's tablet stuff. It's you know, there's the web too, but I mean, there's such a huge base of people out there with tablets, and it, like Cheryl said, it's growing every year, and it's, you know, it's not going away. It's going to take over.
Well, it's an exciting project. MSU journalism professor Cheryl Pell, along with students Danielle Turcotte and Nate Zamanek. Thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up Wednesday on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Open Door Ministry of downtown Lansing. We also preview the first Spartan Sports Journalism Classic, all that and more, tomorrow right here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer of the show. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Gabrielle Saldivia and Sonia Treewaller for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.